ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Big tech and the Australian government are going through kind of a long public awkward breakup.
These companies have snubbed their noses at governments in Canada, Britain, Australia for many, many years.
Social media is doing harm to our kids, and I'm calling time on it.
So what does this mean for democracy? And can we fight back against the tech broligarchs? From If You're Listening, this is Australia versus the Internet. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
When did Australia become a nation of swingers? There's more soft and undecided voters than ever before in this election. As rusted on support for major parties wanes, it's been waning for a while, but it's accelerating. Independents and minor parties are moving to fill that void. So as the major parties try to court key votes in order to form government, whether it's minority or majority, what are the key seats to watch and which way will they swing? Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis, and today I'm joined by ABC election analyst Casey Briggs. And Casey, thanks so much for taking time to be here with me. I mean, this is kind of like your Christmas, right?
It is Christmas, but also, I mean, I guess I get about as much sleep as kids do around Christmas time as well. It's an exhausting last few days before the final big night, but I'm pumped. I'm getting more pumped by the day.
I know. I get really pumped too, actually. People are like, you must be tired. And I'm like, no.
Do you crash? Like at about 11 p.m. on election night, I crash every single time and I then have to sort of motivate myself to continue going the next day because I think the adrenaline of the night has coursed through my veins and you just sort of run out of steam.
It must be like my body keeps going for a whole week after an election because I get really excited about the next bit. Oh, it's like new shiny toys. Oh, there's either a new government or, oh, there's going to be new ministers. And, oh, like I'm...
You're just binge watching politics, that cliffhanger at the end of every episode.
I'm like, oh, it's the new season. Yeah, I get a bit like that. People keep saying to me, are you going to take holidays? I'm like, hell no. What will happen? It's too exciting. Anyway, loser. Okay, now, Casey, as well as running the numbers and memorising the candidates for every single seat across the country, praise be, you've also put together a wonderful doco series called Swingers, which is awesome and excellent. And I know lots of our listeners would have already watched it. If you haven't, you're missing out. It's not about partner swapping or 70s keys in the middle, which I heard about from others whose parents used to have wild parties in the 70s. I don't know. not in my ethnic family, my friend. But essentially kind of a party swapping or moving around type. Just walk me through what's the difference between a swing voter, a soft voter, an uncommitted voter. Or is it all the same?
Yeah, they all sound much the same, right? We've had so much fun putting this series together. It's really great sometimes, as interesting as the hurly-burly of the campaign is, it's really interesting to step back and look at how are we as a nation changing over a long period of time. And that's what we've been trying to do with swingers. Swingers, short for swing voters. Your swing voters are your people who are up for grabs. They could swing wildly from one election to the next. You know, some people like to think of them as transactional voters. I think that's maybe true for some, but not all swing voters. And then you've got soft voters, which are, you know, they're the kinds of people who maybe lean one way. Maybe their family has a history of voting one way, but, you know, they're not quite so sure about the current guy. Or maybe that other person, you know, could convince them. Maybe they, you know, default to voting one way, but they're convincible. And so campaigns have these sort of phases, if you like, as well. You've got campaigns really trying to lock in their soft voters early on. You don't want to have to worry about the people that are leaning your way, but maybe need a bit of cajoling to sort of commit and lock in. You'd like to get them in the can as early as possible so you can spend the final few weeks of the campaign laser focused on those swing voters, the people who genuinely change their mind from election to election. Used to be not very many of us were swing voters. It is growing and it is growing and it is growing. And now we have a lot of swing and soft voters. It was, you know, roughly half of all voters before this campaign began. It's obviously tracked down as we've got closer to election day. But the number of swing and soft voters creates all this unpredictability. And we should say people are not swinging the way they used to as a metronome between the Labor Party and the Coalition. They're now potentially swinging to an independent, to a green, to a different minor party. Maybe they're swinging to a right-wing minor party and then coming back to a major party. There's a lot of unpredictability in all that, how that works. And that can create surprises on election night, which is always very interesting for us as journalists and potentially very terrifying for the parties.
Yes, that's right. And that's what's happening at the moment, right? So we're recording this on a Tuesday, and I think it's important to note that a lot of the campaign dynamics I think we're seeing, especially from the person you'd have to describe now based on published polling as the underdog, who is Peter Dutton, the opposition leader, is really about messaging to those voters who haven't yet broken, as the saying goes, like they haven't broken or chosen a side yet, right? Mm. So they are up for grabs, and the final messages are trying things, whether it be welcome to country ceremonies or, you know, anything that might they might nod to and think more favourably that you are in agreement with them, right? Let's talk about how many there are, because that's the key thing. Early this month, Essential Polling found only about half of Australian voters know who they would vote for. And if you looked at the last four, you know, the fourth debate of the four debates on Channel 7, even at the end of all of the sections where they were showing how people had voted who had been in the room for Channel 7, you know, so many still I found interesting. Mm. Couldn't decide between the two. So yes, okay, maybe Albanese won on cost of living. But if you looked at the uncommitted still, it was still significant, Casey, even after they made their pitch. How significant is that number there? How many still haven't made their bloody minds up?
A little bit hard to know because there's lots of different ways you can measure this, but you've given a number from Essential. Here's a number from the Resolve Political Monitor. They conduct polling for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, the Nine newspapers. In February, late February, they ask a question. The question is really simple. How firm are you with your vote? So they've asked people, how are they voting? And then they say, but how sure are you? In late February, that number was 39% of people saying they weren't sure. They were uncommitted to the party that they said they would vote for on that poll, at least. That has shrunk, but not by a lot, right? Like, it's 30% in the most recent Resolve Political Monitor. That was a fortnight ago. That was before voting started. We can expect that it will have shrunk even more. But 30% is higher than it used to be at the end of the campaign 20 years ago. So we have, you know, a really large number of people on it. It's really been interesting, PK, watching the campaigns, and we've seen, particularly on the coalition side, some pretty significant policies coming quite late in the piece. Now, as of last night, 3.2 million people had voted at early voting centres. People that, you know, if there are any more policy announcements to come, should we also say, if there are any policy costings to come, they have not heard them. It was interesting seeing such a significant policy being launched at the party launches. I was at the Liberal launch in Western Sydney not that long ago. James Patterson said to me then, because I asked him, it's a bit late in the piece to be announcing this very big, significant housing policy that you're trying to grab people's attention with, isn't it? People start voting in 8 or 9 days. And he was firm. He thinks, you know, much like it's always been, there are a lot of people that are not paying attention until very close to the election. And so their strategy is, well, you announce it closer too, because that's when people will start thinking about it. I'm not so sure that works as much as it used to. We watched, for swingers, we watched the focus group in which we heard a parade of people say that there's a lot of cynicism. They were saying, well, yeah, we're hearing about this health announcement now, but I also know it's about to be an election. Why should I have any faith they'll follow through with what they do if I've been watching them for the last 2.5 years? So I think there's a real question over whether the sort of splash of a campaign matters to some of those voters as much as it used to, or is it seen as a cynical move by particularly those less rusted on voters, the people that are most important in campaigns? And do they kind of see it as, well, you're splashing cash around, it's a bit incrementalist, we'd like to see something a bit bigger and bolder, and in order to do that and convince us that you're honest about it, we need to see it earlier in the parliamentary term. So I think there's a question in my mind about whether that strategy that we're seeing in this campaign, which is a traditional strategy, it's how they've always done it. I think there's an acknowledgement that the world has changed, but I don't know if the campaigns are quite on the front foot as maybe they need to be.
We've seen a big rise, as we were saying, in the, you know, a third party vote, minor parties, independents, on the left and the right. It's a thing. Last election, we saw that teal wave wipe out, I think, a lot of historically blue ribbon seats, places that should be, were always, certainly in my lifetime, very much blue seats. You could feel it. I go to those same places now, and you can feel the difference too, actually, in terms of the politics of the place. There is a really significant shift in the way, you know, they used to be called the, and I hated it always, but doctor's wives, you know, the doctor's wives seats. And they were a bit upset about refugees under John Howard, because I'm old, so I can tell you this, a bit upset about the treatment of refugees, but they liked sort of right-wing economic policy. They broadly stuck with the Liberals, even though they were not always happy about it. Now they've gone to the Teals. Are the Liberals on track to really get some of that heartland back? That will be key. Or might that bleeding to these you know, independents actually increase even?
Well, we've got this really interesting test for Peter Dutton's strategy on Saturday, right? I mean, that's ultimately what we're working up towards. And the question will be, well, the strategy, we've seen Peter Dutton start to visit some of those independent held seats this week, I think was the first time we've seen a visit to McKellar. It tells you something about their hopes of regaining those seats. The focus has been on the outer suburbs. The focus has been on the traditional Labor coalition contests, which is to be, you know, something that parties have done for a long time, right? An independent wins a seat. You don't see Labor competing much in the seat of Clark anymore that Andrew Wilkie holds. They kind of just give up on it at that point. You've sort of seen a similar thing here happen with the coalition. But the test is going to be, when you've lost so many seats, where are you building a new coalition to replace that with? And so if Peter Dutton does, and the coalition does not pick up many of those suburban seats, well, then they've lost a key part of their heartland and they haven't replaced it with anything. And the question after the election would be, what do they do next? The flip side of that is maybe they do pick up those seats and this is a political masterstroke. You don't need those doctor's wives, so to speak. And of course, very dysphemistic term, as Tony Barry likes to remind us. Most medical graduates are women. But, you know, you've lost that part of your base. What are you replacing it with is sort of part of the key strategy here. Look, seat polling is very hard to read. It's very imprecise. It's not a perfect science because of the sample sizes involved and the difficulty in getting really good samples there. But what we're seeing from individual seat polls, from MRP models, is independents in many of those, particularly the inner city seats, appear to be holding up at least enough to be competitive. You know, there's not a wipeout that we appears to be on the cards. So appear to be competitive, those independents. We'll see after Saturday night just how large that crossbench is. The coalition, while fighting to win seats off Labor, could find itself losing even more seats to independents. The Nationals could have some troubles in regional areas. If they're not careful, the Liberals could have some trouble in some areas as well. So I think Saturday night's going to be an interesting contest where we might see seats going in all directions. And that's not really, like, you always see, you know, a couple of seats go either way, but generally the trend tends to be in one direction. We could see much more complexity to that tapestry this time because of the local factors, because of the vast array of options and candidates and different kinds of races that we're seeing, and the way that we experience and talk about and think about politics changing quite rapidly in this, you know, internet era.
Few questions on this. The right-wing vote. One Nation's vote looks pretty strong at the moment. And then there's, of course, the trumpet of patriots. Now, I don't see strong polling for them yet, but God, I cannot get them out of my bloody life. Like, and everyone feels the same way. The text messages, the ads.
They're quite long ads too, aren't they?
I don't know how convincing they are. Like, they're just sort of a monologue it's like a monologue. I don't know if you kind of are captivated by it, but either way, they're spending a lot of money.
It's interesting with the advertising and the money, especially PK, that the, you know, when you look at digital spending data, some of the digital platforms publish where parties are spending money for transparency purposes. You can see strategies of targeting among most candidates. You can see Labor's going after certain seats. You can see where the coalition's spending its money. For the trumpet of patriots and the UAP before it, they're just blanketing everyone. Everyone gets the ads. It is a real, like, let's throw spaghetti at the wall approach to advertising, because money is no object for that party, whereas money is a constraint for other parties. But on your question about the One Nation vote and the One Nation support getting higher, there's always the caution of polls are always going to struggle to capture small groups of people and accurately measure them. So there's always more uncertainty around a group that's polling, you know, 5% compared to a group that's polling 40%. So that's just the one thing to keep in mind. We'll find out on Saturday and Sunday where the numbers lie. It seemed to be for a while there, when the UAP deregistered, the One Nation vote grew, and it seemed to be that there was a group of people that were One Nation slash UAP voters, and now that UAP is not an option, I'll plump with One Nation. The Trumpet of Patriots is a new brand. People are less aware of it. Clive Palmer has not been at the front of the advertising in the way that he has been in the past. So there may be a sort of brand cut-through issue there. But
a moment of self-awareness for Clive, maybe.
Potentially. But yeah, it seems like there's maybe a sort of right-wing group that sits with those two parties, and when one's more viable than the other, they sort of transfer one way or the other. But as I say, how influential will they be? Are there certain seats that they could do quite well and make a difference? We'll find out soon.
We will, so we don't even have to, you know, go on about it, right? But I do think, like, the way that preferences will go will be key on the night. Just give people who are listening, I want them to start, like, getting excited about our coverage, because they should be, right? Because, I mean, I know lots of people are. I have people all the time that come up to me, you know, in random places and say, can't wait to Saturday night. So people are. They're excited about democracy. They're excited about our coverage. What should people look for? Like, what are the seats that you, Casey, will be obsessively refreshing the results on?
Well, first of all, you and I, PK, get to sit about 3 metres apart from each other on Saturday night. So we'll be best friends all night.
Steal my beating heart.
Look, it's funny talking about key seats in 2025. That list used to be pretty straightforward, right? Now it's all of a sudden quite a complicated factor. You know, I've been drafting a story for the ABC News website this week about the wild card seats. Where are the seats that, if we were to see surprises, could we see surprises? Mm-hmm. And I started writing the list, and I kind of found myself with a very, very long list in the end. I had to cull it down because there's all these local, you know, candidates and factors and issues that could potentially drive things. I guess let's do the sort of form guide for, you know, what am I looking for in the very first instance? Well, polls close on the East Coast first. First thing I'll probably look for is, what are we seeing in Sydney and Melbourne? Are we seeing significant swings? Are we seeing swings that are large enough to deliver the coalition Labor-held seats in those cities, and enough of them? That's probably your first indication of whether Peter Dutton from the coalition is in any way competitive. If they're not picking up very many seats there, or they're losing seats, in fact, it's going to be very difficult for the coalition to form government, nigh on impossible. If they're winning enough that they, you know, are in the hunt to, you know, that they, we might be talking about a world where, okay, are the coalition and the Labor Party of similar size in the parliament, or are they larger? Then we need to start looking around in other parts of the country. Then we're looking at Queensland. You know, the coalition hold the vast majority of seats in Queensland. Not a lot of room for them to grow there. Mm. Labor hopes to gain some seats there. Could they offset some losses there? Seats like Leichhardt in the far north. Could they win a seat off the Greens? A seat like Brisbane or Griffith? You know, that would help if we're seeing Labor pick up seats in that part of the country. Maybe could they potentially be on track to win majority. You're looking at Tasmania, where there's a couple of seats. There's only five seats in the state, but you're looking at a couple of seats to see, could there be a swing on there? Again, only a couple of seats that are really in play in South Australia, and the Northern Territory has a couple as well. And so you're becoming, you know, if you're in this world where in Victoria and Sydney, the coalition's picking up, I don't know, eight seats, you're in this very scrappy contest all of a sudden. It's seat by seat by seat. And then all of a sudden we are hyper-focused on the seat of Sturt in South Australia. We're hyper-focused on the seat of Lingiari in Solomon. We're looking at Bullwinkle in the west. You know, maybe Western Australia again becomes a state that we're waiting for hours to get some clarity on what's happened. So I think early indication from Sydney and Melbourne, that will tell us if we're in for a long or a short night.
That's brilliantly done. I think that's right. Yeah, I'm kind of obsessed with, like, Werriwa in the west of Sydney. Mm. You know, if they can't win a seat like McEwen in Melbourne, I'll be thinking, what? Like, what? Where's this strategy going? Because, you know, you think that has to fall for the coalition. And then, yeah, seats like Sturt, I'll be thinking about some of the debates we've had, like some of the culture wars that have come out, the Trump light stuff, and whether that's hit a place like Sturt in South Australia. Labor's long talked up Sturt hasn't happened. Can it happen? They're all the interesting dynamics, right? And then, of course,
And look at the polling figures, right? You've got a national polling average that is pointing toward a almost status quo, maybe a small swing to the Labor Party. We would not contemplating that as an option a few months ago. On a state-by-state basis, William Bowe has this website called The Poll Bludger. He's done a state-by-state breakdown. Victoria is a problem for the government, it seems. A swing against the government looks like it's on the cards there. But in almost every other state, at least the states we have enough polling in, potentially swings toward the government. Again, it's small. It's all well within the margin of error. Mm. I think, you know, status quo or small swing toward the coalition is absolutely still possible. But, you know, then you're in territory of like, oh, could Labor win a few seats? Could Labor pick up a couple? And that's all they'd need. If they could pick up a couple and offset, you know, the seats like McEwen that maybe they lose, then all of a sudden you're in a good world again where we have maybe another very slim Labor majority or, you know, a Labor minority where there's really no other viable government.
Mm. And that's actually their strategy at the moment in terms of what is the national director of the party organising as we speak. It's that. It's, okay, let's write off a few seats in Victoria. They don't want to, but they're realistic.
Mm.
Where do we gain to offset those? And that's actually the entire strategy that they've been playing. And it appears, if we to believe, you know, the polling, to be working. I have another question, which I think is an important one, because people would have heard this a lot. Now, we're not talking a lot about all the press conferences, but I'll just give you a little update. We've had the Prime Minister's press conference. He's, you know, gone in hard with his treasurer talking about, the S&P warning in relation to our AAA credit rating and defending their budget strategy, all of that. Peter Dutton's actually had to put off his press conference because there were protesters there, so that's been cancelled. But they're currently frenetically travelling the country trying to sell their messages. One thing, though, that I find intriguing and worth picking your brain about, because it comes up from regular people who are interested in politics all the time, is why does Peter Dutton keep talking about how his internal polling is different? A few people have said this to me, and he has. He did it again. I think he went on Sky and he's going on Sky again. Interesting strategy. A lot of Sky. And there he's like, well, you know, the media, remember he called the ABC and the Guardian hate media. The media has a narrative. Well, look, the media is only reporting the published polls, right? But he's claiming that there is something else going on in his polling. Is that plausible?
Oh, well, it's entirely plausible that there's something else going on in his polling. The problem is we have no visibility of that, right? So the Liberal Party is using a company called Freshwater. Let's lift the lid on a bit of how this all works. They also produce public polls for the AFR. Those public polls for the AFR that Freshwater have been producing have tended to be better for the coalition than the sort of average of the polls. I'm not saying that they are wrong. I'm just saying that they are different. I always like to look at the polls in aggregate. For the record, we should also say the company that produces News Poll for The Australian, they are doing polling for Labor. It's a pretty small industry. And the people doing public polls for newspapers and media companies also have other commercial clients. That is just how the industry works here. The thing about the comments that the coalition is making is it's so much about expectations management, these campaigns. There is a real thing as an underdog effect. You want to be seen as, you know, not miles ahead and not miles behind. You want to be seen as we're competitive and maybe we're a little bit behind and we need to give that push. That is sort of a documented, there is a documented effect there of that making a difference in some people's minds. So the coalition is spinning. They are spinning a story based on their internal numbers that they think is going to encourage people to come out and volunteer, encourage people to donate money to the party, encourage people to maybe not flirt with that independent, instead vote for the major party. The problem is we have no idea what their internal polling is. When one poll does get dropped out from the internals, you see that from time to time, internal seat tracking leaked by blah, 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 or leaked to a newspaper, you're seeing one of very many polls they're doing. And all polls have some measure of statistical noise to them. They're probably giving you the one that looks best for them. There may be others that don't look quite as good. So you're getting a cherry-picked sample, whereas at least with the newspaper polls that are on a regular sort of pattern, you can at least kind of trust that they're not conducting 17 polls and giving you the best one because they're doing them every month. So there's that sort of transparency is in the favour of the public polls. You know, they may not be perfect, but we can be more hopeful that they are a good sample. We can't really say that of the internal polls. It is entirely about an expectations management thing where we do see specific polls leaked. I mean, they don't just sort of fall off the back of a truck. They're being given to a journalist by someone for a reason, right? And so that's sort of the thing to keep in mind.
Look, as a previous receiver of polling in my other roles in the past, absolutely. Yeah, there is a motive, you can tell, right? You know, they're trying to tell you, hey, these are, you know, this is the real story. And there is a lot of public relations in all of that and public management. It'll be interesting, though. I do think it's a seat-by-seat proposition too. My view is that there are different stories across the country. Yeah. And that makes sense, right? Because, you know, in WA, the experience of the cost of living crisis has been different to in Victoria. Like, you know, there are different stories.
Totally. So the brands of the parties are of differing levels of health across the states as well, to put it politely. And, you know, we are focusing, there is a focus on national polling because it's the main thing we see. It tells us a story, but the world is very fragmented now, and that may create quite a bit of differences at the local seat level that, you know, are not being captured by national polling. So, you know, the polling is pointing one way. The position for the government is clearly stronger, but that doesn't mean there are not pathways for anyone, well, either of the two men who'd like to be Prime Minister, to scrape something together on Saturday night, and we may well see anything happen.
Casey, that is very true. I can see pathways, my friend. There are many paths to get to, you know, Mount Everest.
There are 150 seats. There are a lot of different combinations.
There are. Casey, you know I love hanging out with you. Look forward to Saturday night. And the final episode of Swingers is on ABC iView tonight at 9 p.m. You can catch it on ABC iView and YouTube or wherever you want to see it. Worth a watch. My sister's a big fan of yours. Sometimes I'm like, you love me too, don't you? She's like, I like you both.
Both of us equally.
Thank you very much, Casey.
Thank you, PK.
Politics Now. We'll be back tomorrow. Guess what? David Spears and I in the same studio going through the day's politics. Cannot wait. If you want to send a question to me and the party room, send it to theparty room@abc.net.au. Fran and I will answer it on the party room. See you, Casey.
See ya.
Hi there, Yumi Steins here, host of the podcast Ladies, We Need to Talk. We're all about health and wellness, sex and relationships. If it's going off in your group chat, we're going to talk about it on Ladies, We Need to Talk. Perimenopause, fertility, your love life, the mental load, Ozempic. Nothing's off limits. Find Ladies, We Need to Talk on the ABC Listen app and all the usual places.